Tukisi bunga. Tukisi bunga. I am Madeline Alakrelle. Inuvunga, tukisi bunga. Nakormik, thank you for listening to this episode of Words and Culture. Atsunai!
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e minen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kako utau. We'll see you again.
Hey, do you want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, I have the perfect show for you. Come hang out with me at Raccoon City every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Hope to see you there.
This is Bird Note. Yellow-crested cockatoos are victims of their own charisma. Talkative and sociable, they stand over a foot tall, with snowy white plumage and a showy yellow crest. Due to widespread trapping for the pet trade, this bird has disappeared from many of the Southeast Asian islands where it once lived. Today, it's considered critically endangered. But scientists recently discovered a stronghold for the species, Komodo Island. You know, the one with the dragons? Past surveys of the island focused on easy-to-access coastal valleys, and they suggested a sharp decline in the yellow-crested cockatoo numbers to just a few hundred individuals. But when researchers surveyed locations across the island, including the forbidding interior, they arrived at a more accurate population estimate, 1,100 individuals. It's a stunning number, considering the worldwide population could be as few as 3,000 adult cockatoos. This suggests that, unlike many other islands, the Komodo population of yellow-crested cockatoos is stable. Komodo Island has been an Indonesian national park since 1980. The scientists think that park rangers may have helped deter poachers, but community support for conservation and the literal dragons have played a role too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centres Canada in making a difference today.
If you were to walk into Trent University's Battle Library, you would see something unexpected. Just inside the entrance of the typically quiet library, there is a functioning pop-up workshop and someone building a birch bark canoe. Throughout the month of October, Alex LaBelle will construct this canoe from start to finish for all to see.
Well, last week on Monday, I was actually commissioned a couple months ago to build a canoe for Trent, and I wasn't sure where I was going to be building it, and I came here, Battle Library, in the summer, and they said, this is where you're building it. So Monday I came in and unrolled the bark and started folding it up to take the canoe shape, and now it's about 20% done. So there's still a lot of work to be done, about 800 feet more of route to be tied on there. So it's definitely a big project.
LaBelle is relatively new to building birch bark canoes on his own, but has been around them for most of his life while working with his grandfather.
So, originally my grandpa started a couple years, I think maybe 22 years ago, and he started building in schools, and he wanted to retire about 6 years ago, and he's built about 10 canoes since, so he's trying to pass it over to me. So I said, I'll take this project and you take a break from it and actually get a chance to retire. So that's why I'm here, and I wanted to carry on the tradition because he's been able to pass it on to me since I was 5 or so years. Like, when I could understand what was going on, he was able to pass it on to me. So mm-hmm. since then, I've been traveling along with him at his builds in schools and universities everywhere across Canada, and actually it sent him to Peru, so really? That's pretty cool.
And this project comes from Trent University's First People's House of Learning, or FPHL, and LaBelle credits the idea to elder and knowledge keeper Lorenzo Wheatung, who grew up in Curve Lake and works as the cultural advisor for FPHL.
I've traveled around a little bit, and I've seen a lot of birch bark canoes hanging up or on a shelf somehow, adorning a place. And I thought we needed one that we can use. We can actually get in and use it. So I talked to Don Laval Harvard over in the First People's House of Learning. Mm-hmm. And we decided that, yeah, this was something we'd take on. But in the planning stages, the dreaming stages, we said it had to be done in a good way all through. So we had a feast to ask Alex if he'd build this canoe. And we had traditional food there. And so the canoe did begin in a good way.
So this canoe build is largely was Lorenzo's idea. We had built a canoe with the First People's House. I think it was probably back in, maybe 2017. We had a little bit of a pot of money, and the students wanted to learn how to build a traditional birch bark canoe. Now, recently, we have led a number of living off the land canoe trips on Manitoulin Island the last 2 summers in a row as part of some, reconciliation dollars that we received. And some of the feedback that we got out of that was, how amazing it was to participate in this experience, to go on the canoe trip, to, have some teachings about living off the land. But it did come up at one point that, how amazing it would be to learn how to build the actual canoe that they were traveling in. And so we put our heads together and we made a request actually to the Sisters of St. Joseph, who have been incredibly supportive. They have, made some pretty good contributions, especially helping us create an endowment fund to support Indigenous students' needs. And so they were very generous in finding some dollars for us to build this canoe.
Dr. Dawn Laval Harvard is the director of the First People's House of Learning, and she spoke a little about the cultural significance of the birch bark canoe.
The canoe was essential to our survival. I mean, we often joke that, when you're little and everybody envisions Indigenous peoples and they think of, the sort of riding horses and teepees kind of Indians, so to speak. But our people were on the waterways. Our people were fisher people. We survived from the fish. We survived and we traveled the waterways across this province. I mean, especially all around the Great Lakes. And we were not horsemen and teepees. And so this is the central to our survival piece of technology that allowed our people to trade. It allowed our people to, big war parties would go down in their canoe. It allowed, whether they were out harvesting rice, whether they were out, I know Alex was joking this morning that this canoe would be big enough to load a moose in, mm-hmm. but it has to be big enough and functional enough because that's the survival of your family. That's the difference between surviving through the next winter or not was your canoe. And so the skills to build a canoe, which, unfortunately are disappearing, and that's why Alex and his grandfather being here is so beautiful. And they're helping to teach some of those skills to our students who are having that ability to participate and help, even if it's just in a small way, mm-hmm. in passing on that tradition, because that was literally the difference between surviving the next winter or not was if you had your canoe. Mm-hmm.
So they came up with the canoe. That's the canoe's blueprint is based off of your body. The skin is the birch bark, actually. So, starting off with your skin, the birch bark represents that. Then, under your skin, you have muscles. And because this is an incomplete canoe, you'll see later on there's a picture on that slideshow, actually, that has a start of the inserting of sheathing and ribs. So the sheathing is about 3 to 4 years of sapwood off the cedar tree, and that's most flexible. So it's like our muscle. It protects the bones, the ribs, and the ribs are made of the hard wood inside of the cedar tree. So that's your bones, your muscles, your skin. And then to hold everything together, we use spruce roots, and those represent your tendons, holding everything together. When we wrap along the canoe's gunwales, we use 5 holes, and then we reuse those 5 holes on the way back after wrapping 5 one way, and then we'll come back 5 the other, and that represents 10 digits, so your fingers or your toes. So that's the aspect of that. And then when you cut yourself, you bleed. So we asked the spruce tree if we could use its blood, the spruce gum, to seal the seams and the cuts that we make in the bark to make everything fold together.
And this project is more than just a canoe build. It's hoped to be a learning opportunity for students. And even while we were talking, multiple students were assisting LaBelle strip bark from spruce roots. But it's also intended to be a reconciliatory act to reclaim Indigenous knowledge at Trent, as LaBelle Harvard explains here.
I really encourage anybody who's listening to come sit with Alex. You will get to actually put your hands in building this canoe and contributing to what will be, you know, in future generations. You'll be able to say, I remember I helped build that canoe when you come, because it will be here for another 100 years. It will last. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having it be that product, and that's why it's here in the middle of the library. So after we did that, we have the new library staff are really very committed to their reconciliation strategies. And they had come forward and asked if there was something we could do together. And we had mentioned that we wanted to build a canoe this year, and I jokingly said, well, we could do it in the library, and they were 100% on board. They have been fabulous for doing this sort of archival stuff, for putting together, you know, different resources for the learning opportunities, and for students to come and see the sort of larger context of learning about the canoe.
You can find LaBelle working on the birch bark canoe just inside the entrance to Battle Library until October 25th, after which there will be a naming and launch ceremony in the Otonabee River at a time that is yet to be announced. This has been Eddie Sweeney reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative and for CFFF FM 92.7, Trent Radio here in Peterborough, Ngozi-Wenong.
We're all aware of the challenges our online spaces present, like online hate and the spread of misinformation. But how can the average person make our online world more positive? Studies have shown it takes just 10% of the people in a community to set its values. We're all digital citizens, and we all have a role to play. Join Media Smarts, Canada's Center for Digital Media Literacy, on October 23rd for Digital Citizen Day to help make our online world a better place to be. Visit digitalcitizenday.ca to find out how you can make a difference.
Dr. Marie Wilson came to the Picton Public Library last week to share her experiences as the Truth and Reconciliation Commissioner and how that affected her personal life and subsequently motivated the writing of her book, North of Nowhere, a first-hand account of her participation as a commissioner and her personal reconciliation journey. The discussion was moderated by museum curator Jessica Chase, born in Peterborough on the traditional territory of the Williams Treaty's First Nations. Dr. Wilson was the only female and non-Indigenous member of the TRC, whose extensive background included award-winning journalism, broadcaster, and pioneer of Northern Canada's first daily televised news service. Originally from small-town southwestern Ontario, Dr. Wilson has spent most of her life living in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, with her husband, the Honorable Stephen Kakfui, former Dene Nation Chief and Northwest Territories Premier. Dr. Wilson begins the session with her own words.
This book that I have written is really, in a way, an effort to provide another tool for sharing the teachings that were given to the Commission and that were entrusted to me to help make as many Canadians and others know as possible what happened in Canada under Canadian laws, under Canadian policies, and under the operational leadership of Canadian churches. That is really a pivotal part of understanding what the TRC was all about. So I just thought I would just very briefly recall some of that and then see how it leads to my decision to write and offer up this book. So just to know that when we talk about residential schools in Canada, to know that there was in the original treaties that were foundational to Canada's establishment as a nation state, there were signed treaties, and some of them were unsigned, and were but all were deemed to be mutual obligations. And one of the things in the written treaties included a commitment for education. But it did not include or prescribe that the education would be far away, in far away places, and that children would actually be removed from families and communities. It was also not understood that Canadian laws would make Indigenous children obliged by law to go to school well before non-Indigenous children in this country had a legal obligation to go to school. You may not know that.
Through the course of their work, the commissioners would hear accounts of abuse, malnutrition, sexual abuse, and friends disappearing or dying. Jessica asked Dr. Wilson how she coped listening to such tragic narratives every day for 6+ years.
Was there a routine, let's say, when you would finish a day of listening to very intense survivor stories? Is there something that you always do to kind of recover from that?
One of the things I did every single day was I called home. I called home, and not, as you say, to kind of debrief with family. On the contrary, I've never debriefed with family. As you've noted, and as you heard in the reading, my husband is a residential school survivor. So one of the responsibilities I had was to not bring harm to him. We had an overall responsibility to do no harm, which was constantly on our mind. And we always said the survivors are at the heart of our work, but my husband was also a survivor, so I couldn't go home with that kind of, you know, the stereotype, oh man, honey, I had a hell of a day at the office. Like, that was not going to be a model that was ever going to work for me.
Of course, being the only non-Indigenous commissioner, mentioned it a number of times in the book, of feeling, will people trust me with their stories? How were those doubts quelled? Were there any times when they weren't? But yeah, how did you deal with that? I mean, we always use that phrase, imposter syndrome, like the idea of that feeling of just not being the appropriate person. How did that play out?
Well, my feelings about it, how that played out, is they were soon set aside, because never once ever in any community was ever made to feel anything but welcome. And sometimes I was actually sought out, because there were people who wanted to speak to the commission, and they specifically wanted to talk to a woman because they specifically did not want to talk to a man. And so basically that was a judgment I was putting on myself, in other words, out of my own sense of guilt, I think, about on behalf of society, you know, just feeling all that and knowing all that. But I was never made to wear it in any way that felt like I was being dismissed or disregarded. I was made to feel welcome and appreciative. And I think it's because I actually, you know, when I would go into communities, I wouldn't say much. I really listened. I thought my job here is to set the scene and help people understand, because not everybody understood the intricacies of that great big court case. And how does the TRC fit into all that? And so some smaller version of what I said to you today repeated that every single hearing, and telling myself, do not get sick of that. It's really important. People didn't have access to the court records and the documents, and not everybody was at the negotiating table. It was really important for people to understand, first of all, there were a whole lot of heroes in your midst who fought really hard to make this happen. And secondly, we're not here to decide whether or not you should get compensation. We're not here to talk about the quality of your lawyer. We're here because we have a big purpose, and it's really three-pronged. One is to gather, document, record, and preserve for posterity the fullest possible account of residential schools in Canada as we could. Secondly, educate the people of Canada. And thirdly, to inspire ongoing reconciliation. And so if we explain that this is what we're here for, and you, the survivors of the schools, you're the expert teachers in this context.
There was a brief question and answer period from the audience, followed by book signing and interaction with Dr. Marie Wilson. For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. This September 2024, Prince George Clavey today lost two respected and influential language and knowledge holders. Josephine Paul passed away Wednesday, September 11th, at the age of 92. Tragically, less than a week later, on Sunday, September 15th, her daughter, Edie Frederick, passed away in a traffic accident. An innumerable amount of people in our community have been mourning this loss. On October 2nd, a procession began from a Queensway funeral chapel to the Clavey Tenay Band office at 1041 Huanun Road. The wake lasted for 5 days until October 7th, when a funeral service was held at a cathedral off of Patricia Boulevard. Everyone in our community was welcome to attend these events. But to make room for all and to share stories and heartache with one another, the Prince George Civic Center was open at 808 Canada Games Way for over 4 hours in the evening of Monday, October 7th. Family, students, friends, acquaintances all gathered sharing songs, stories, and began the long road to healing. The loss of both Edie, or Edith, Rose Frederick, and her mother Josephine Paul leaves a void in our community. We ask some of those in attendance how individuals in our community can begin to address what feels like a wide open space in the wake of this significant loss. Emily was able to share her thoughts with us.
I think a big thing would be more drumming and singing, coming together as a big group to drum and sing and teach the younger ones the language. And even me at my age, I'm 30, and I would still love to learn a lot more than I already know. I only know a few of the basic words, but I'm definitely going to look into learning how to say the vowels a lot more so that I can speak it a lot more fluently than I already do right now, especially because my Auntie Edie was such a big part of it. So I'm really excited to start learning and actually getting back into singing again, because I haven't sang in a couple years, so I'm excited to get back to that.
This is kind of a spur in that direction in a way.
Yes, definitely. She brought a lot of people together. She was such an amazing woman.
Totally. Thank you.
Clarence John, one of Edie Frederick's first cousins, touched on the impact of her legacy.
Well, the people she teached, some of them know, there's already a few of them already taking their steps already right now. It's a huge, huge step to replace, but it can be done, right? It's never over, so we do have people, a couple people doing it. We still have another elder to do language too, so the community is together now, and then we all talked about it before already. We know it's a huge step, but, you know, it could be done, and there's already people they can speak to too, so, like, the program for school, like a lot of children can be learning too. So yeah, too. So yeah, they already did, because they know her pretty good. So
yeah,
she touched a lot of hearts around schools too.
The ball is rolling. It's just a matter of keeping it, pushing it.
Yeah. Lawrence Seymour.
Thanks, Lawrence. What do you think are some ways that people in our community, in Prince George and beyond, can kind of help to fill the void that is left in the loss of two really incredible knowledge and language keepers?
Yeah, it's really hard losing two knowledge keepers, because a lot of people didn't try to learn the language, and, you know, that's pretty sad, but now we lost them, and there's nobody around to speak the language anymore that's fluent, But there's other elders out there, you know, and they could teach too, you know, but just nobody wants to learn. That's the thing. Like, my dad grew up in residential school. He wasn't allowed to speak his language. He knew it fluently, but he never taught us nothing, you know.
Yeah.
And that was pretty hard. Yeah.
Are you yourself interested in learning the language?
Oh, yeah, I am. Like, I don't really want to lose it, you know, because it's very important, you know, that you know your language. I go to other reserves, I don't know what they're saying, you know. and pretty much the same dialect, you know, but I just don't understand any of it, eh?
Yeah.
And it's kind of embarrassing, but then, you know, you got somebody there telling you what's going on and what they're saying, and it's pretty cool.
Was there a trigger point for you when you realized this is actually something I really want to learn?
This kind of happened recently, you know, losing these two people, eh? And, you know, I wish I spent more time with them, but, you know, I'm not mobile and stuff, and it's pretty hard, you know, like, because I would love to learn the language, you know. I know a few words, but they're not good words. You know, any language is like that, eh?
Yeah.
You learn the bad ones first.
Yeah.
It's Gary Seymour, Clately Today.
In the wake of, you know, the loss of Edie and her mother, do you think there's any ways in which people can kind of participate in filling the void that's left by her absence?
You know, it's going to take the next generation to step up and actually start learning the language. My mother started teaching my daughters. Edie was a big part of that. You know, she really was in there. She taught them a lot. They were in a drum group together. That's how they started learning their Dakath language. And I think that's what is going to have to transpire after this. Because, as you said, right now we're in a void. We're going to have to come together as a community, which we have already. The last few days have been amazing to see everybody show up and show their respect for Edith and Josie as well.
Something that was just mentioned to me, too, was some of those, I want to say, like, baby steps in that direction. Just practicing some vowels.
Yeah.
Just the little stuff. Is there anything like that you might be able to recommend to anybody who might be listening?
Honestly, they're not right now. We're in the building stages, right? And everything's in the building stages of getting these courses going, teaching the kids, and not only the kids, but us. I'm 56, and I barely know any of the words. And I understand some when they talk, but once it's up to me, then I'm pretty much out of commission in that sense, right? But even like Emily was stating earlier, the drumming is very important. The singing, that is really important to us, eh? And that was one way that they taught. And Kim Gucci sang a song earlier, a counting song, and she had everybody in the audience singing with her, eh? So that songs like that, that will teach everybody. You know, they make it fun. You don't even realize that you're learning at the time, right? But then later on, you're singing or humming it to yourself, and then you're remembering the words and that, right? So, and that's how we'll be able to start getting some of it back.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
In the background, you're hearing Roger West perform at Edie Frederick's Celebration of Life, which occurred Monday, October 7th at the Prince George Civic Center, 808 Canada Games Way, on the traditional territory of the Clately Tene First Nation. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
From natural disasters to unforeseen accidents, emergency preparedness is a crucial element of maintaining a safe school environment. Canada's diverse geography means schools can be vulnerable to a range of natural hazards, including severe weather, flooding, wildfires, and earthquakes. National School Safety Week is October 17 to 23, and the Canada Safety Council urges schools and communities to focus on strengthening emergency preparedness protocols. Find out more at CanadaSafetyCouncil.org.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.